Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a podcast about climate science and climate scientists. Today, we're talking with Colleen Lecrae. She's an awesome scientist working on the global carbon cycle.
And I am Mike White, Nature's editor for climate science. Now, of course, for regular listeners, you'll know that was Vaughn and White, my six-year-old son, who has now lost both of his two front teeth and is even more adorable than usual. We're here broadcasting from the East Coast branch of Forecast, more specifically in my father's basement here in Vienna, Virginia. You know, I was at the Great Antarctic Climate Hack, this really fun meeting down in San Diego at Scripps, very interesting ideas about how to transmit geospatial data to, pretty much anybody in the world who might want to have it. Awesome work being done there, and many thanks to Nancy Bertler for inviting me to come. But at the time, the fires in the North Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area were just absolutely raging. And I talked to my wife, and we basically decided to evacuate. We live in the East Bay, so not super close to where the fires were up in Napa and Sonoma Valleys, but the air quality was absolutely horrible. So I ended up leaving the meeting early, getting home, and just taking off the next day with the family. Flying out to the East Coast early. My younger brother is getting married on October 22nd. So we just got out of Dodge, took off, made it out on the flight. The house itself was never in danger, but it was the whole feeling was pretty darn apocalyptic. It was raining ash out of the sky. The air quality was horrendous. It's gotten better, but then again, it's gotten worse since then. So I'm glad we made it out here. Thinking back to what I've done on the podcast, I realize I've never really explained exactly what it is I do at Nature. And essentially, I handle the physical climate system. So any paper whose main conclusion relates to the physical climate system, which means atmospheres, oceans, hydrology, and the cryosphere, is under my remit. And I make the primary editorial decisions about whether or not to have it reviewed in the first place. And then, if so, managing that review process. And my colleague, Julian Mosinger, runs our biogeochemistry section, which includes the carbon cycle. So what it means is that if a paper is about the effects of ocean circulation on the carbon cycle, Julianne handles it. But if it's about the effects of the carbon cycle on climate, then I handle it. But in reality, we end up seeing each other's papers quite a bit and advising or recommending reviewers, as the case might be. And what that means is that I see a lot of papers that do involve the carbon cycle. And that was an area that I used to work in as an academic. So today, I was really very excited to be able to talk to Corinne Lecrae from the University of East Anglia, who's one of the international leaders in carbon cycle analysis, originally working mostly in the oceanic carbon cycle, but now orchestrating huge efforts for the Global Carbon Project, trying to synthesize and digest this huge swath of data from ocean atmosphere and land carbon cycle, trying to come up with essentially a budget for the carbon cycle on an annual basis. It's a daunting task, but one that's fascinating and politically important because it directly influences the discussions at the UN about what we're going to try and do societally in terms of carbon mitigation. I hope you enjoy the talk and have a better feeling at the end of it for what's really going into trying to diagnose and put numbers and uncertainties on the global carbon cycle. So here it is, my interview with Corinne Lecrae. And as a side note, I am here in the basement of my father's house, so the audio quality is not as great as usual. Fortunately or unfortunately, the interview is only about half an hour. Corinne Lecrae from the University of East Anglia. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hello, thank you.
At this point, you're one of the world's best known scientists for working on the global carbon cycle. You had an incredibly influential paper in Science a few years ago looking at the possibility that there was a reduction in the carbon sink in the Southern Ocean, but science wasn't at all your first choice as a career. What did you almost end up doing?
You mean when I was looking into what I was going to do with my life, essentially?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, there's no scientists in my family. So for me, science was kind of, a little inaccessible in a way. And I liked science at school. I had a good physics teacher in particular. When I had to decide what to do, I decided I wanted to be a sports teacher. I went to register to a sports program. I picked one that I like. And as it happened, I rang them up and I asked to register. And it happens I had missed the deadline by one day. And what they said to me, it was just come back next year. And of course, when you're 18 or 20, next year seems like a world away. And I just had a second thought and I rang up the physics department and they said there, oh, no problem. We take everybody here. And so that's what I did. I did physics. I mean, it was pretty accidentally, I have to say. And then I just continued to drift into more and more things that I liked. Then I did oceanography. Then I did carbon cycle and climate science. And it was all more of a drift. You know, I didn't start with a target in mind. I'm going to be this. No, I just did things that I thought were valuable and fun. And that's it. And here I am. And I still do that now.
Do you at all regret the pathway that you took? Or do you wish that you had had that one extra day to go into sports teaching?
Not one minute. I mean, we have so much fun in science. We control what we do. It's always new. It's always interesting. We have progression. We get to meet people that think alike and are different. We have so much opportunities. I would have had opportunities as a sports teacher, but probably, you know, with age, you get a little bit less, you know, flexible and so on. I think my end of life might have been a little bit more difficult.
We both got our PhDs in the same year, 1999. That was when you got yours, right?
That's right.
Your paper in Science about the Southern Ocean Carbon Cycle came out in 2007.
Yeah.
From 1999 until 2007, can you walk me a little bit through the pathway of your research interest that led to that paper?
Yeah, I did my thesis on the variability of the carbon in the ocean. Uh-huh. And I was doing a lot of modeling at the time. So using model to sort of understand what's going on. And I got increasingly frustrated that there wasn't enough observations. I could model all I wanted, and I never really knew for sure if my model was correct or not.
Yeah.
And so I was in Paris. I did my PhD in Paris, and then I was offered a job in former East Germany, the Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry in Jena. And mm-hmm. that was part of when the Germans reunified the West and the East, the Germans injected a lot of money in the East to build infrastructure and so on. And so they built Max Planck Institutes and got a lot of people to get together. And it was an exciting moment in Germany. I mean, it was a rebuilt moment and there was a lot of activities and so on, very stimulating. So I went there for a few years and I met atmospheric scientists there. And the people I started to work with people who look at the ocean from the atmosphere. Uh-huh. And I realized that it would be possible in the Southern Ocean, where there is no land, essentially, it would be possible to infer what the ocean carbon sink is doing in the Southern Ocean from the atmosphere. And so we decided to do this, but we were not looking at trend at the time. We were looking at something that's called the Antarctic Syncopolar Wave. So it's a wave that goes around Antarctica. And we thought, well, maybe we can see it from the observations, the atmospheric observation. So we were looking for that. It was a long time in the making. It took us 4 years to do this paper. There were so many details and issues with the stations, and then we were not sure we had the setup correctly with the data, and it took really a long time. But in the end, we found that we didn't actually see the wave, but we saw a trend which was actually much more interesting.
So you failed in your initial goal, but found something much better instead.
Yeah, that's right. It happens a lot in science, doesn't it? It happens a lot. You're looking for something and then you say, oh, well, what is that? And then you go on a tangent.
I think that this paper, I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating somewhat, but I think this paper really kicked off a huge revolution in Southern Ocean observing, and then just intense interest that something that people had kind of been counting on as oceanic sink of CO2 might not be there for the long duration or might be changing substantially.
I mean, we always knew the Southern Ocean was a bit mysterious and it could surprise us in the future, but we actually did think it was relatively stable recently. And so we viewed, I think up to then, we viewed the uptake of carbon by the ocean, this carbon we put in the atmosphere goes in the ocean, as a relatively passive process. Mm-hmm. And that paper we published was probably the first one that showed with observations that actually much more is going on than we think. And I mean, I like to think that, yes, it triggered a lot of research, but there were a lot of people that were observing the Southern Ocean and were conscious that there's something there that we should be looking at. And I think the paper really pushed in that direction, and there was a momentum because people were prepared to hear.
One of the really interesting things about the Southern Ocean and the Southern Hemisphere is that it's simultaneously the most unpopulated part of the planet and the most isolated in Antarctica, but it has one of the strongest imprints of human activity in terms of ozone depletion. Can you talk a little bit about how that knowledge about ozone depletion and its interaction with the westerly waves has influenced what we see in the Southern Ocean both then and since then?
Yeah, what we think is happening in the Southern Ocean, I mean, there is climate change, of course, which has impacts all over the planet. But at the pole, there's also the effect of ozone depletion. And in the Southern Ocean, what's happening is the depletion of the stratospheric ozone here, so at the top of the atmosphere, has changed the circulation of the winds around Antarctica. So the winds have actually become stronger. You see a very clear 50-year increase in winds, and the winds, they drive the ocean currents. So this ozone effect, we think, is the main process that we were looking at in our paper published in 2007 here. So you have increasing winds over the Southern Ocean. And what happens there is this wind mixes the ocean up. And the ocean is a huge store of carbon. So there's a lot of carbon in the ocean, 50 times more than the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So if you start mixing the ocean up, then you're bringing this carbon that is normally in deep waters and you're bringing it up to the surface and exposing it to the atmosphere. And that means you're outgassing old carbon, essentially. And if you have stable winds, this doesn't happen. Then your carbon is just trapped in the ocean in a way.
Now, you also mentioned that when you were beginning your work, you were frustrated by the lack of observations. Mm-hmm. And something that's happening right now is that we have the growth of the Argo float network, but also more recently and ongoing is Argo BGC. So the ability to monitor things like pH or things that are relevant for the carbon cycle in the oceans. How do you feel that particular observing network is going to change what we understand about the Southern Ocean?
Yeah, it's very exciting, the amount of observations that is emerging or about to emerge in the Southern Ocean. I think it's going to be fantastic. I mean, this is not far off having satellite coverage of carbon to have these floats. And it's actually in a way even better because the floats go up and down. So you don't only see the surface, but you see what's going on inside the ocean. And having
right,
these
sounders.
Floats, yeah, that's right. These floats with, and then you can get at, I mean, the nutrients, the nitrogen, phosphorus, you can get at the chlorophyll, which gives you the biological activity. So you can understand not only what's happening, but why. And that's really critical. I mean, it's just the early phases. I mean, it's been a few years, but you need to deal with the possibility that measurements drift and so on, but still is just really exciting.
Do you think that the oceanic carbon cycle research is going to face the same issue that the atmospheric reanalysis community faced when they had the ingestion of satellite data in 1979-ish or so, and that alone caused these major discontinuities in the time series they were trying to generate? Is the same thing going to happen, do you think, with the oceanic carbon cycle?
Possibly, yes, but it's a good problem to have more data, and then you deal with the discontinuity is much better than not having data. You just deal with the problems. If you don't have anything, you haven't got any problems.
One activity for which you're very well known now is your activity in the Global Carbon Project, or the GCP. You were the lead author on, there must be 100 authors on this paper that came out. And you have regular annual updates. And overall, you're trying to compile all the available evidence that we have about the three major pools for carbon on land, in the atmosphere, and in the oceans, and diagnose on an annual basis what's changed in each of these pools, including geographically, and what the trends have been. And to me, this just seems like one of the most daunting possible problems to try and tackle scientifically. When did the community realize that there was a really pressing need to do this? And what kind of inertia or initial organizational problems were there that you had to overcome?
So we first talked about this, it was in 2004, so at a meeting of the Global Carbon Project, where we realized that policymakers are really actually working hard to try and tackle climate change. They meet every year or even twice a year sometimes. And yet the scientific community is actually a little bit behind that. We produce information, we produce peer review papers, we produce major assessments, but really only every 5, 6, 7 years. And so we thought, actually, we got to be able to do a little bit better than that and at least keep up with what the policymakers are doing with some of the basic science. And so we started relatively simple. I mean, we had one estimate for the ocean. It was my model. And then we had one estimate for land use change. And so it was relatively small initially, but I really liked it myself as an effort because coming from the ocean, I always had the assessment of the ocean carbon sink, but I was never challenged. You know, I could just say, this is what I think the ocean sink is or the variability is. But at the end of the day, you have mass balance in the environment. So the carbon that you put in the atmosphere, it has to go somewhere. So if I say my ocean sink is X, well, that means that so much has to be in the atmosphere and so much has to be on land. Right. And by bringing the information together, you get challenged because you get the others say, well, it cannot be so much on land because look, I have this piece of evidence here. And so the dynamics of the carbon budget, we call, that we did every year has grown and grown and grown because it has been so interesting to be challenged in this way. What we faced in terms of institutional challenges is mostly to do with the continuity of the funding, because we've been lucky we've had funding, not a large amount, mostly funding for the coordination. Everybody who contributes to the carbon budget brings their own funding. So people will have funding to do their piece and then they submit it a year and we compile it. But some years we've had more funding than others and we just had to fill the gaps between with like our own time or, you know, people who have come to the fore and said, well, can I help this year and so on. And so that's been the most difficult thing, was to just weather the ups and downs. But I say this, and this is really quite typical in science. I mean, look at the Keeling curve, the long-term atmospheric CO2 measurements. I mean, how on earth did they fund this time series for 60 years is the same.
Well, Dave had an incredibly hard time getting it funded.
Exactly. And some years they had funding, some years they didn't. And do you see gaps in these curves? No. They just got things done. And so it's a little bit the same for us. But I can't say it's always easy, but it's certainly always valuable and always interesting and fun.
I was just at a meeting called the Great Antarctic Climate Hack. The main purpose of that was to explain to the observational community and more old-style modelers and data users the new ways that geospatial data are becoming available. But during the course of that, I learned a little bit more about the relative uncertainties in the different pools. And just at a very high level, it seems like if you were to place an uncertainty of one unit on the atmospheric carbon, then you'd have about three or four uncertainty units for the ocean, and maybe even more for land. Is that like an approximate order of magnitude correct level of uncertainties relative among these different pools?
Yeah, that's about right. The uncertainty in the fossil emission is growing, though, because we have more of it. So as you get more countries emitting CO2, you have more regional differences in the emissions, and that's growing. But yeah, I would say the land, and particularly the land use. So how much from deforestation and management of the land? This is a really tough one to corner.
So the one number that we do know reasonably well is the atmospheric composition, but the atmospheric composition tells you nothing about what's actually being emitted by societies, because it's just the residual of all the other fluxes that are going on. How do you actually go about bringing together an estimate of the greenhouse gas fluxes from anthropogenic activity?
The atmospheric measurement, yeah, that's measured directly, and you're completely right that the uncertainty there is very low. Yeah, so that's made of the balance between the emissions and the sinks. And for the emissions, we use energy data. They're converted to CO2 emissions. You kind of know, you have some measures of how much emissions you have for coal, oil, gas, for example, and then you can convert that to fossil fuel. That's done by centers. So the Carbon Dioxide Information Analysis Center in the U.S. did that. And we build based on their estimate here. And so you have that. So at the base is energy data. Then on land, at the base is deforestation data. But then that's much more difficult, because for the energy data, you take the coal and you burn it and the emissions are straight in the atmosphere. But right. For deforestation, you have all kinds of time scales. So you cut the tree, you take the wood, you bring it somewhere else, then you burn the vegetation, then you have the soil decomposition. So all of these things, so wood is stored for a long time, then the soil decomposes slowly. So all of these things introduce delay between when you do your intervention or disruption and when the CO2 goes in the atmosphere. These delays and all the uncertainties around that's very tricky to estimate. And it's even so tricky that at the moment we don't even know globally if the emissions from land management is increasing or decreasing. We don't know. There's inconsistency in the data. There's inconsistency between the satellite data and the country reported data. And the models yet do something else. And we just don't know. We have an idea of the size. We have an idea that it's not so variable year on year. But apart from this, is not very satisfactory.
And then at the same time, you have this residual land sink, which is presumably the uptake of carbon from the atmosphere into land from things like forest regrowth or changes in agricultural practices. So you're having to balance both the fluxes coming out from deforestation and similar processes relative to the uptake in the contrary processes. And it just seems like it's been an issue that's been bedeviling the land carbon cycle community for at least 30 years. Do you see any hope that this is going to get substantially better in the near term?
Yeah. I mean, the estimates of the carbon sinks are fascinating, because they tell you so much about the way that the carbon cycle operates in the environment. And so when we have these emissions, then they go partly in the ocean, partly on land. In the ocean, you can estimate these things, both of them, the ocean or the land, with models in which you have all the processes and you impose atmospheric conditions from weather forecast models that are
right.
Reanalysis. There's so much variability on land year to year. So you have an El Nino event that disrupts the temperature and the rainfall patterns, and you get
fires
and everything, and you get very large fluxes on land, in and out of the land. Same thing when you have volcano eruptions. But still, in spite of all this variability, the land models are increasingly better. So the land models come near what we can infer from observations of what the mean land sink is and what the trend in the land sink is. There's still a bit of a ways from variability, especially decadal variability. And that's also true for the ocean model. The decadal variability is not very well captured.
Mm-hmm.
I think through the years and maybe the last 10 years in particular, we've improved a lot in our understanding, but we still are quite stuck by the lack of observations on land. On land is really, we don't observe the carbon sink, the terrestrial sink on land. We don't observe it, at least not at the resolution that we need.
Except for the anticovariance tower, which is not the right resolution.
Yeah, that's right. So these are very good because indeed they get at processes, but it's local process. And when you start integrating this over latitude bands or continent, this is where you get the trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what you are talking about is absolutely fascinating because you have the situation now, which you talked about in the last version of the carbon cycle report, which was out in Earth System Science Data about a year ago. Is that it looks like the anthropogenic emissions of carbon have largely tailed off. Not that they're zero, but that the rate of increase has plateaued for the past year or so. But nonetheless, the atmospheric concentration is still going up because you have these large releases that are related to the variability in El Nino Southern Oscillation processes. So, I mean, it's a system where you have multiple fluxes going on all over the place simultaneously. When you try and bring this sort of insight to policymakers or those who are involved in the UN negotiations, would you say, well, it's still going up, atmospheric CO2 concentration, but emissions are flattening? I mean, do they grasp what's going on? Do they understand the nuances, or is it really hard to get across?
Well, I would say the smart ones get it, but I'm joking. Actually, I mean, it's not complicated when you think about it, but policymakers and people in general, the public, they get bits of information here and there, and they
right.
sort of make it up as they go along because, you know, the interest is sometimes very marginal in what's going on. So they might hear, yes, the emissions have flattened in the past 3 years, and then you get record high in CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. And actually, these things are completely consistent with one another.
Yes,
as
yes.
long as we have emissions that are not zero, so we're putting carbon in the atmosphere, of course the concentration keeps increasing, even mm-hmm. if we don't put any more emissions than we did last year, which is what's happening now. So the emissions are not growing. They haven't grown for 3 years. Then the concentration still keeps going because it's not zero what you put in the atmosphere. And so when you explain this and when people take the time to think about it, then it's obvious. When you just mm-hmm. read a newspaper heading, then it's not so obvious. I'm making an effort. We're making an effort in the team this year to try and talk more about the global carbon cycle and not just about the emissions, so that you need to build the general knowledge in a way that there is a carbon cycle and that it's influenced by El Nino and there is variability, but still the emissions, they need to go down to zero to tackle climate change. I think having these carbon budgets that come out every year is also it's a blessing in a way, because we think, mm-hmm. well, last year was complicated, this year we'll, you know, present it this way or talk more about the atmosphere and so on. And so you can sort of correct, you get a second chance in a way.
Yeah, you get a lot more opportunities than you would in the IPCC process.
Yeah, indeed.
Back when I was first getting going in this podcast, I talked to Gavin Schmidt about the relationship between economic activity and the CO2 growth rate. And I think for a long time in the carbon economy community, there had been this assumption that there was some kind of a fundamental linkage between economic activity and carbon consumption. And at the time, we were beginning to see this, you know, signs of a decoupling, that you could still have economic growth without having the similar kinds of carbon consumption that we've seen in the past. And now it seems like that's continuing. How does the community, your community, feel about this when you talk to economists? Is there a growing recognition or discussion of the idea that you really could have this major decoupling between carbon and the economy?
Well, I mean, it's not just you could have it. I mean, we have to have it. I mean, unless you don't want to have an economy, you have to decouple. You have to decouple the energy from the emissions. But it's a big question whether that's happening already and in which country and what. I mean, it's clear that as the economy grows, some of the economy is based on materials, so creating stuff and consumption. Some of the economy, not all of it.
Yeah.
And so what you need to do is to have more of your economy that is not based on stuff. That's a blessing. And then for the part that is based on stuff, then you have to produce energy differently. It's not so clear to me that this is already happening now. I know a lot of people talk about it, and I know that there are countries where GDP is growing and the emissions are coming down. But still, if you look in the short term, you still see when the economy is down, then the emissions are down a little bit. What we need to have is the emissions down a lot more for other Right. reasons, for reasons of efficiency, because we focus on services instead of focusing on, you know, having a big car and driving long distances. You rationalize a little bit how we use and produce the energy. And that's happening for sure. I mean, whether it's happening, it's certainly not happening fast enough. And that's the reason why the economy wiggles in a way, still transpires in the emissions, because what we're doing besides that is not quite fast or not quite big enough. But certainly that train is in motion.
Well, I guess the Global Carbon Project also has an upcoming meeting, I think, in something like spring of 2018, to try and look at the idea of negative emissions, which is the idea that we would not only be reducing the rate of growth, but we would be drawing down the atmospheric CO2 levels by having uptake of carbon. There's a lot of options within this category. What do you and the broader community see as being the top one or two candidates for making rapid progress on negative emissions?
Well, the one we talk a lot about is bioenergy with carbon capture and storage.
BECCS, right?
BECCS. So is the one that has kind of emerged from a modeling construct. So if you take a model that projects energy, how energy changes in the future, and you tell that model, look, I want to have energy in the future, but I don't want to have emissions, and I have so much land, and I have so much storage facility underground, because we took carbon from underground, so there are some empty pockets there. And the model comes up saying that actually it is possible to produce a lot of bioenergy, which we already know, but it's also possible to capture it and put it underground. But because models are models, they have really come up with quite large amounts of BECCS that are possibly economically feasible in the future. And what we're doing in the carbon community at large now is to look at, well, I mean, is this actually feasible? I mean, taking so much biomass, first, has it got really no emissions, or what kind of emissions are associated with this?
Right.
Does it compete with other things like food production, or can we actually grow really on land that is not used for anything else? And is it aligned with the storage and so on? This is the one that we scrutinize the most because it has so much implications for the rest of the carbon cycle. There are other ways. I mean, maybe I should say before that part, the part of the carbon capture and storage part of this, so without mm-hmm. the bioenergy, just capturing carbon and storing it, to me is a no-brainer. It has a cost, but it has not much technological obstacles. So we have the know-how, the large stores on the ground. And so really the obstacles there are financial obstacles and obstacles to say, well, you can't actually put CO2 in the atmosphere anymore, and that will happen. It's really the backspout, the bioenergy and carbon capture and storage that is problematic.
Corinne Le Carré from the University of East Anglia. You know, it's one of those rare times when you talk to somebody about climate change and there are actual glimmers of hope. also the director of the Tyndall Center. Thank you so much for the talk today.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
And that was my interview with Corinne Le Carré from the University of East Anglia and the Tyndall Center. Obviously, you know, there was a ton of stuff we could have gotten into about life at the Tyndall Center or growing up in Canada, but time was short. Maybe next time. If you like the show, I encourage you to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or whatever your favorite podcasting application might be. You can also subscribe on the show notes to get email notifications when the next episode is available. You can go to forecastpod.org for that. You can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com or on Twitter. I'm at MWClimateSci. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guest, and not necessarily those of Nature or our parent company, Springer Nature. Coming up sometime soon, I'm really excited to be talking to Sonia Senevratne from UGH Zurich, who of course is a IPCC author of the famous SREX report on extremes, and is doing all kinds of fascinating work on extremes and a huge range of other topics, including the new and pressing issue of 1.5 degrees Celsius arising out of the Paris Accords. I'll talk to you soon.